And it is another week. This is Andrew Wood, Executive Director of Hope Resource Center. Thank you so much for tuning in. We are grateful that you are partnering with us by listening to this show, whether live over at Joy 620 or by the podcast. You can find it at investinghope.com. You can find it on Google Play, Apple, iTunes, wherever podcasts are found, you should be able to locate this show. We, again, are thankful for that. You can also follow us over on Facebook, A Conversation on Life with yours truly, Andrew Wood. And all we do over on that Facebook page is I'm going to be posting links of articles that I'm either reading or referencing to on this show. And so, again, we are thankful. Last week was the week. Last week we had our virtual banquet, and wow, did you ever show up? We're just blown away by your partnership and your support of Hope Resource Center. As you know, if you've been listening to this show, we had to make a call an audible on our in-person banquet, and we had to go to a virtual banquet. And would you believe that over 2,500 people have tuned in either the night of or since have tuned in to watch the virtual banquet? That's six times the amount of people that we typically have at an in-person event. And so we are grateful for that. The donations continue to come in, and we just could not thank you enough for your support and partnership in the work that we're doing at Hope Resource Center. If you didn't get a chance to watch the event live, or you haven't got a chance to watch it yet, you can go to investinghope.com. You can also find it over on our Facebook page. You can also find it on YouTube. Just click Hope Resource Center on YouTube, search Hope Resource Center, and you'll find it on there as well. Today, what I want to do is we're going to talk about a couple of topics. One of those being, this may surprise you, COVID-19. Yeah, we're going to talk about the coronavirus because, well, that's what everybody's talking about. But I'm going to focus on something that I don't think has received enough focus during this conversation, during this pandemic, during all the press conferences, all of that. And that is the vulnerable population that call nursing homes their home. And I think as the numbers continue to come out, it's really something that we have a blind spot, not just here in our country, but around the world, to those that are affected and that have been affected by COVID-19. Before I get into that, I also want you to know that as we go on through the show, we'll talk about some information coming out of Washington concerning abortion during the pandemic. And we'll talk about, of course, the work that's being done at Hope and other places around the country. But first, this is what I believe. When all this is over, I think we're going to see that we did very little to protect the most vulnerable to this virus. Now, look, this show every week is talking about the most vulnerable population, and that is the unborn. But what we also know is when it comes to this pandemic, the most vulnerable population is the elderly. The elderly that have pre-existing conditions. The elderly that live inside of nursing homes. And I think when all this is said and done, we're gonna realize that we did very little to protect the most vulnerable during this virus. New data is currently showing in some parts of the world that half of all deaths occurred in nursing homes. Now think about that. There's an article right now over at the Washington Post. It's titled "Nursing Homes Linked to Up to Half of Coronavirus Deaths in Europe." This according to the World Health Organization. Up to half of coronavirus-related deaths in Europe are occurring in long-term care facilities such as nursing homes, the World Health Organization said on Thursday. An assessment that suggests public health authorities may have allowed the pandemic to rage among some of their most vulnerable populations as they focused on hospitals and other aspects of their response. A deeply concerning picture is emerging about residents of homes for the elderly, a top official for WHO's in Europe said at a news conference. According to countries' estimates, he said, up to half of those who have died from COVID-19 were resident in long-term care facilities. This is unimaginable human tragedy. The official warning was focused on Europe, but the United States also has struggled with the pandemic inside homes for the elderly. A Washington Post analysis this week found that nearly 1 in 10 nursing homes in the U.S. have reported cases of the novel coronavirus, with a death count that has reached the thousands. Many European countries have banned family visits to nursing homes in an attempt to shelter the residents from the spread of the virus, since it is far more lethal among older people and those with pre-existing conditions. But those bans, though well-intentioned, may have deprived the elderly of advocates as conditions swiftly deteriorated. This pandemic has shown a spotlight on the overlooked and undervalued corners of our society. That's what the official at the World Health Organization had to say. He and other officials who spoke Thursday said they do not have enough data to say conclusively that people in nursing homes were being transferred to hospitals less often than they should be, or that they were being discharged from hospitals prematurely, fears raised by advocates in Britain and elsewhere. But the officials hinted strongly that those factors might be contributing to the high death rates. Now the thing about all of this is the nursing, New York even, now listen to this. What you have seen in the media and on cable news outlets is that the administration in Washington is doing a terrible job, and that the administration in New York is doing a wonderful job, and the administration in California is doing a wonderful job, and the administration in Georgia and Florida and Tennessee are putting us at risk by opening those states back up. Now, what's the difference between New York, California, Tennessee, Florida, and Georgia, and the administration in Washington? Now remember, they said New York is doing great. California is doing great. You have Governor Gavin Newsom in California, Governor Cuomo in New York, both progressive. The president in Washington, D.C., has an R beside his name. The governor of Tennessee, the governor of Georgia, the governor of Florida have R's beside their name. That's why the media is reporting it this way. And then what we find out today, actually we found out last week that Governor Cuomo came out and said, yeah, I think it's best now that we start cleaning the subway every single night. Excuse me? You waited till 6 weeks into a pandemic to believe that you need to clean and disinfect the subway? And now what we're hearing, news out of NBC, New York forces nursing homes to take recovering patients and infections and deaths increase because of it. Listen to this. The coronavirus patients began arriving last week of March, transferred to the Gerwin Jewish Nursing and Rehabilitation Center under a New York state mandate, requiring nursing homes to accept those recovering from COVID-19, even if they still might be contagious. Did you catch that? We have been told since the beginning of all of this, the most vulnerable population to this virus, and the ones we wanted to protect more than anyone, were the elderly and those with pre-existing conditions. The first outbreak that we saw in Washington State, where did it happen? Inside of a nursing home. We knew from the very beginning in this country, from the very beginning, that those in most danger to this virus were those in a nursing home. And in New York, they required, under a mandate, nursing homes to accept those recovering from COVID-19, and here's the kicker, even if they still might be contagious. At the time, the Long Island nursing home had only one resident who had contracted the virus, according to the facility president and CEO. A month later, Gerwin, that nursing home, is battling an outbreak that's killed 24 residents for hospital transfers and one staff member who worked in housekeeping. And the nursing home is still mandated to take recovering hospital patients known to have the virus, potentially increasing its spread in the facility. We can't say for sure whether the virus is spread because of the patients transferred under the state mandate, the CEO said, but it's certainly not helping the situation. What are we doing? The article goes further. Three states hit hard by the pandemic, New York, New Jersey, and California, have ordered nursing homes and other long-term care facilities to accept coronavirus patients discharged from hospitals. The policy, intended to help clear in-demand hospital beds for sicker patients, has prompted sharp criticism from the nursing home industry, staff members and concerned families, as well as some leading public health experts. Nursing homes are working so hard to keep the virus out, and now we're going to be introducing the new COVID-positive patients asked David Grabowski, a professor of health policy at Harvard Medical School. Instead, he believes that states should create COVID-only facilities for recovering patients discharged from hospitals. Now, here, think about the logic behind this. We went to great lengths setting up makeshift hospitals to make sure that we had beds available. And then you have these states requiring nursing homes that are housed full of vulnerable populations to this virus. They're requiring them to take on COVID-19 patients, even if they're still contagious. And then you want to claim that you care deeply about those that are in danger of this virus. Then you sit on a press conference and you say, you do not love your neighbor if you go back to work, while the governor is mandating nursing homes to take patients that are still possibly contagious. And these numbers will undoubtedly go up. That's the scary part. Listen to this. Virus claims at least 7,000 lives in U.S. nursing homes. The first warning of the devastation that the coronavirus could wreak inside American nursing homes came in late February when residents over in a facility in suburban Seattle perished one by one as families waited helplessly outside. In the ensuing 6 weeks, large and shockingly lethal outbreaks have continued to ravage nursing homes across the nation. Undeterred by urgent new safety requirements, now a nationwide tally by the New York Times has found the number of people living in or connected to nursing homes who have died of the virus to be at least 7,000, far higher than previously known. In New Jersey, 17 bodies piled up in a nursing home morgue, and more than a quarter of Virginia home residents have died. At least 24 people at a facility in Maryland have died. More than 100 residents and workers have been infected at another in Kansas. And people have died in centers for military veterans in Florida, Nevada, New York, Maine, Massachusetts, Oregon, and Washington. On Friday, New York officials for the first time disclosed the names of 72 long-term care facilities that have had five or more deaths, including the Cobble Hill Health Center in Brooklyn, where 55 people have died. At least 14 nursing homes in New York City and its suburbs have recorded more than 25 coronavirus-related deaths. In New Jersey's officials revealed that infections have broken out in 394 long-term facilities, almost two-thirds of the state's homes, and that more than 1,500 deaths were tied to nursing home facilities. That's where we are. Folks, we knew from the beginning that this virus was deadly to the elderly with pre-existing conditions. We knew where ground zero would be, as nursing homes house many of the demographic that are vulnerable. We knew nursing homes were going to be a battleground, but we did, it seems, very little to protect them. We put a great deal of focus on ICU beds, on ventilators, and on secondary structures to house the expected overflow. Now, I'm not arguing that that was a waste of time. We acted quickly to curb the expected shortages. That was a good decision. We brought in Navy ships at the harbor in New York. Samaritan's Purse in New York City, who've now been kicked out because they're Christian and not woke enough, opened up makeshift hospitals to care for those expecting an overflow in the hospitals. We did all of that. And it seems no one on their list of strategic measures said, hey, why don't we protect our nursing home facilities? Shame on us. We're going to talk more about that when we come back. Your presence is my greatest weapon. Pushing back the darkness, breaking every chain. My worship opens up the heavens. Crushing every stronghold when I speak your name. So as we continue the conversation today, looking at, of course, COVID-19 and the vulnerable populations that have been affected by this, those being in the nursing homes, I think it's important that we understand what has occurred over the last 6 or 7 weeks or however long it's been at this point. Now again, we put in a great deal of focus on ICU beds, on ventilators and secondary structures to house the expected overflow. I'm not arguing that that was a waste of time. We acted quickly to curb expected shortages, and that was a good decision. And as I was saying earlier, we brought in naval ships in New York because the models were showing we weren't going to have enough ventilators. The models were showing our hospitals would be overflowed, and just we were going to need something. And so rightly, we put things in place. We prepared for what the models were saying. Now, praise God that those models were wrong. Not just a little wrong, but way wrong. Now we can argue why they were wrong. We definitely curved the virus, and we definitely put some things into place to make sure that we didn't get it. We didn't get all the infections immediately. But at no point in doing that, in bending the curve, did we think the virus would just disappear. Of course not. We were just trying to get us more time. And that's what we've gotten. To the point in now, states like Tennessee and Georgia and others are starting to open up. Colorado. California is even instituting a plan to start that process as well. But it seems, now it appears that in our haste to prepare, we neglected the most vulnerable demographic. And in some cases, even put them in more danger by requiring these homes to take in recovering patients. Recovering patients, mind you, that could still be infectious. Now think about that. And the article that I was mentioning earlier actually said that because they said no more guests were allowed in these nursing homes, that the families of these patients at these nursing homes couldn't fight for them. Nursing homes and their patients should have been at the top of any list that looked to protect the most vulnerable to this deadly virus. Now, I get it. Hindsight is 20/20. You know, all of us want to be armchair quarterback. All of us want to be, you know, that's what we do with the Vol football. That's what we do with NFL football. That's what we do with sports. We kind of the next day go, well, if I was the coach in that moment in time, I would have done this. And so I get it. It's easy to play armchair quarterback. It's easy now that we see these numbers to say this. But protecting the most vulnerable should have been at the forefront of all involved with strategic planning. That's the part I don't understand. One of the first breakouts occurred in a nursing home in the state of Washington. Not just patients at the nursing home, but staff as well. And every press conference I've seen has said the most vulnerable population to this virus are the elderly with pre-existing conditions. Now, folks, who do you think make up the vast majority of the population inside of a nursing home? Elderly with pre-existing conditions. And so if one person gets it inside of that building and people aren't separated, the chances of everyone else getting it, or at least a lot of folks getting it, is very high. And so if these numbers hold up and half of all deaths by the virus occurred in nursing homes or by someone connected to a nursing home, well, some folks have some explaining to do. A whole lot of explaining. And see, this is why I've said for a long time, if we do not get life right in the womb, we don't get it right anywhere. Now, what do I mean by that? Because we have a society currently, and we have laws in the books currently that say some life has more value than others. Now, some would argue with me on that, but the reality is because we allow for abortion in this country for any reason, not because you're about to die, not because of deformities, not because of anything, just simply because you want to have an abortion in this country, you can, then we are technically saying, we are actually saying that some lives have more value than others. And so this doesn't surprise me that sitting around a table, folks trying to strategize what to do next, how to protect our population from a deadly virus, it doesn't surprise me that no one around that table went, hey, what about nursing homes? What are we doing to protect them? Because that's where we are as a society. And I get it. They had to make quick decisions on the fly. A lot of people in a room, a lot of voices to hear from. But who's going to fight for the vulnerable? Sadly, many of those in a nursing home may not have the family support that they need. Many of them don't have any visitors. They want to come see them when there's not a pandemic, much less during a time of a pandemic. So who's their voice? Where was the outcry when New York said, mandated, that these nursing homes had to take patients in that had COVID-19? Patients that could have been affected, still infected, still contagious. Where was the outcry? No, but you'll be told, well, if you want to go to Lowe's or Home Depot and do some kind of home project, then you hate your neighbor. While the state of New York and other states like it are requiring nursing homes to take in patients that are going to affect the entire population of that nursing home. What are we doing? That's all I'm saying. We have a value problem in our society. And it's not just here in the States. Clearly, it's across the world. As we see that the death numbers and the infection numbers continue to increase in nursing homes across the world. But you see, it's not as flashy to say you want to protect the vulnerable. It's not as flashy to say we need to protect our nursing homes. It's a forgotten population. They don't have a voice. And so where we find ourselves today is we're finding articles in the New York Times, articles in the Washington Post, articles in NBC News saying, hold on, the numbers coming out concerning nursing homes need to be looked at. Now, how much coverage will they get? I don't know. But if you're the CEO of a nursing home and you're trying to protect your population, and then the state comes in and mandates that you take in more patients because they're just looking for somewhere to put them, and those patients were infected with COVID-19 and still may be contagious, and you're told you have to take them. When we had makeshift hospitals in Central Park, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. The vast majority of the makeshift hospitals that we put together and they were like looking at convention centers all around the country and how can we get hospital beds in there. And at Vanderbilt, they were looking at the parking garage and they had hospital beds there. The vast majority of the extra overflow spaces that we created were not used. But yet we were telling nursing homes they had to take in people that could infect their entire population when we could have just put them in one of the makeshift hospitals and still taken care of them well and served them well and protected our most vulnerable inside of a nursing home. Lord help us. We'll be back. So hopefully today this conversation is fruitful in opening our eyes to some things that are going on that we might have been blinded to. And so we rightly got prepared for this pandemic, and we're still going through it. It's not over yet. And even though society is starting to open back up, there's still some things that are different. I got my hair cut this past Friday and wore a mask. You know, there's just going to be some differences occurring. Even though gyms are opening, some folks aren't going back. Even though restaurants are opening, some restaurants will never open again because of this. Some folks declared bankruptcy because of this. Some folks lost their job because of this. Some folks lost their grandparents, their mom, their dad, their brother, their sister because of this. And so instead of unifying, if you can allow yourself to think back to September 11th, 2001, and what we saw in the days after the Twin Towers came down and the Pentagon was hit and the plane went down in Pennsylvania, what did we see? We saw unity. We saw folks in the South saying that we're all New Yorkers. We saw people coming together and saying that we're here for you. What can we do? You saw people that were Christian, that were Muslim, that were atheists, that were everything in between coming together simply to help. What you also saw at that time was almost the birth of cable news, a 24-hour news cycle. I remember being at my brother's house. I was 17 in 2001. I was at my brother's house, and we never really watched the news together, and that's all that was on for a couple weeks. And all they were talking about was what happened there in New York City. And now you fast forward to 2020, and a pandemic strikes, not just this country, but the world, and thousands are dying. I think we're up to 70,000 dead in the U.S. because of the virus. And you have states that are seeing a light at the end of the tunnel and starting to open up. And instead of celebrating that fact, we're being attacked. You have some folks saying we can't open until there's a vaccine. You have some folks saying that we can never go back to any kind of normal. And then you have this out of New York City concerning Samaritan's Purse. So there's an article over at New York Post by Jonathan Tobin. It says, "No good deed goes unpunished. A group of evangelical Christians discovered the truth of that cruel adage firsthand after some of our local politicos repaid their charity with savage scorn, with City Council Speaker Corey Johnson calling for their expulsion in a Twitter rant. The group in question is Samaritan's Purse, a Christian medical relief organization with a sterling record of providing aid across the globe, whenever and wherever emergency help is needed. Having established top-flight military-grade clinics in far-flung war zones, the group recently did the same in COVID-19-devastated New York City. Its tent hospital in Central Park, built in cooperation with Mount Sinai Health System, treated hundreds of virus patients just when Gotham's hospitals feared they were about to be overwhelmed. True to its name, Samaritan's Purse asked nothing from New York and gave much by taking some of the burden off the shoulders of the health workers on the front lines of the battle against COVID. But that wasn't enough to cause some local politicians to put aside their own lefty prejudices and zeal for smoking out religious conservative boogeyman. The good Samaritans who came to our aid don't share the socially liberal beliefs of most New Yorkers. Samaritan's Purse is an avowedly religious group. It makes no bones about the fact that its good deeds are an image of its faith in the Gospels. As such, its employees are people who subscribe to the group's religious beliefs, as would be the case of any religious organization, whether the Catholic Church or Orthodox, Jewish, or what have you. As an organization, Samaritan's Purse doesn't believe in gay marriage, and that apparently is enough to make its persona non grata to some New Yorkers, including Mayor de Blasio, who vowed to investigate the group just when it was getting started with its rescue mission. Rather than welcome the group's unselfish sacrifice, the folks there greeted it with suspicion and hostility, thus treating the pandemic as one more culture war battle line, rather than an opportunity to unite across the old divides. City bureaucrats pestered the group for information about its cultural practices. Four local Democratic members of Congress, Representative Jerry Nadler, Carolyn Maloney, Adriana Espalet, and AOC, that's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, sent a letter to Mount Sinai expressing their, quote, concern about the group's efforts and demanding to know how it had received permission to operate in Central Park. Mount Sinai pointed out that the virus kills people of every religious belief, gender, identity, and sexual orientation, and that Samaritan's Purse treats all patients. But that wasn't good enough. A well-practiced culture warrior, Johnson was the group's most vehement and least gracious enemy. Now that the crisis has subsided, the field hospital is no longer needed. But there were plans for some St. Meredith's Purse personnel to relocate to Mount Sinai to continue the fight against the virus. But the pressure on the hospital for daring to cooperate with an evangelical group has caused it to decide to sever ties with the organization. As far as Johnson is concerned, it's good riddance. This is what Johnson had to say. It is time for Samaritan's Purse to leave New York City. This group, led by the notoriously bigoted, hate-spewing Franklin Graham, came at a time when our city couldn't, in good conscience, turn away any offer of help. That time has passed. Their continued presence here is an affront to our values of inclusion and is painful for all New Yorkers who care deeply about the LGBTQ community. Now, think about what the guy just said. This councilman just said, they are an affront to our values of inclusion. Now, does that inclusion include Christians? Clearly, it doesn't. No doubt Johnson's posturing is in part a product of his ambitions on Gracie Mansion, but it's still a disgrace. The same is true for others who did their best to demonstrate their ingratitude. You don't have to share Samaritan's Purse faith or assent to its views about gay rights, nor do you need to like its CEO, Franklin Graham, who is widely disliked here because of his support for President Trump and his social conservatism. But nothing justifies the lack of respect for Samaritan's Purse workers who put their own lives on the line when New York was in danger. There could be no greater proof of the sincerity of their faith or their commitment to helping those in need in the image of their master. Yet instead of receiving our profound thanks, they've been run out of town by politicians who think scoring culture war points is more important than saving lives. Now, who are the real zealots? And that's where we are today. You know, we've often asked the question. I've asked it on here. I've asked it on other shows. If we had a 9/11 happen today, would we unify like we did September 11, 2001? I think the answer is pretty clear. This pandemic has been a earth-shattering event here in the States and around the globe. And what have you seen? Every opportunity anybody has to politicize, they have done so. Whether it be the talking heads on cable news, whether it be social media folks, friends, this councilman in New York City. You see, it's not about saving lives. It's about people that agree with you. And if you don't agree with me, then I can't have you. Help me. Which is really interesting. You think that councilman, if he had cancer and needed to see a surgeon immediately, and that surgeon happened to be a donor to Samaritan's Purse and a Christian and someone that believed in the traditional definition of marriage, would that councilman look at that doctor and say, well, you can't operate on me. You're a bigot. I would tend to argue that he probably wouldn't because he wants to be saved. In the same way, when tornadoes rock the state of Tennessee, when hurricanes rock the coast, when earthquakes rock California, when the Smokies caught on fire, when California catches on fire, when Wyoming catches on fire, when all of these tragedies occur, what you should see is neighbors coming to help neighbors. Not walking up and going, well, hold on, before I help, I need to know, what do you believe about marriage? I mean, you know me, I'm one of the most pro-life guys out there. But I'm not going to go and say, well, before I can help, I need to know where you stand on abortion. No, because that's ridiculous. I have strong views. But when it comes to things like this, and you have organizations seeking to help and provide, and then you have other folks seeking to make political points out of it, and the culture war continues, and no one is woke enough. Right? I mean, okay, you've helped us. Now you got to get out of here. I mean, think about the nerve of politicians seeing an organization come into their city and set up shop to help alleviate the stress of the already overstressed medical facilities. And the first question they have is where do you stand on marriage? Not, hey, what do you need from us? Thank you so much for helping us. Thank you so much for stepping in and alleviating the stress. No, it was, what do you believe a marriage is? Aren't you Christian? You can't be here. The Nerd. We'll be back. So as we finish up today, I do want to point you to investinghope.com as you can watch our virtual banquet. And again, like I said earlier, over 2,500 people have watched it already, and we would encourage you to do that. It's half an hour. You get a great story from a patient. Also, you'll hear from our staff, and then you'll get about 7 or 8 minutes from me talking about the work of Hope as well. And you can find that at investinghope.com. You can also find it over on our Facebook page. You can find it on our Instagram page. You can also find it at YouTube. And so we tried our best to put it everywhere that you would be watching. And again, we are grateful that so many tuned in. And it really was amazing to get the text after the event was over, a text from pastors and friends and folks that are connected to Hope in many different ways, talking about the event, the engagement that we saw on social media. And really, it was an opportunity for so many more people who wouldn't be able to come to our banquet in person because they're out of state or because they're, 5 or 6 hours across the state. It just was an amazing opportunity. And hearing from staff members that said, hey, I got family members and friends that are watching this that would never be able to come to our banquet. And it was just really a great opportunity. And the Lord was certainly at work in it. And we are grateful for your partnership. And again, you can find that at investinghope.com. And we would strongly encourage you to share it with somebody. The patient story is just, man, it's so good. It's a patient of ours who chose adoption, and you get to hear from her, but you also get to hear from the couple that adopted her baby. And it is just, it's so good to see how open adoption is a picture of the gospel and how this family has loved on this birth mom and is taken in the baby as their own and also fell in love with the family. Of the birth mom, and just a beautiful picture of what the gospel compels us to do. And so we get bent out of shape and we get all up in arms. And even today, I spoke, for probably 30, 35 minutes about some issues going around our country. But there's so much good going on that we don't see. There's so much good going on that doesn't get reported and doesn't fill the minutes and hours on cable news. But there's work being done. There's lives that were saved because Samaritan's Purse went to New York City. Like, don't get lost in the mess and miss the good that's happening. Right? There's abortion clinics that had to close because of this pandemic. There's lives that have been saved by doctors that willingly went in to go to work, by medical professionals that willingly went in to go to work. And we're all trying to adjust. We're all trying to figure out what the future looks like. But don't let the fear of everything cripple you. I'm not telling you to go be reckless. Certainly not. But don't let the fear cripple you either. And when this is all said and done, this is going to be, we're all going to be affected by this in one way or the other, maybe directly or indirectly. Maybe you lost your job. Maybe you lost a family member. Maybe the company you just started had to close up because you didn't have the cash flow. There's so many things that occurred because of this and during this time. And so what I'm trying to say is on the other side of this, if we walk out the other side of this pandemic and we're even more divided than we already were, then what are we doing? And look, it's not just folks in New York City. It's easy for us Southerners to say that. But the reality is, there's many of us that can't wait to politicize a tragedy. And so we immediately want to point fingers and point blame, and it tends to those that the blame tends to be pointed at those that disagree with us. And so I would just caution you against that. Pray for our leaders. Pray for our medical professionals. Pray for our nursing homes and those that are doing their best to protect the vulnerable population inside of those walls. And if you know someone in a nursing home, the best you can, I don't guess you can go see them in person, but go visit them, knock on the window, FaceTime with them, make a phone call. We need community. We need to talk to somebody. Don't forget about them. If we're going to claim to be pro-life, that's from womb to the tomb. And there's no reason to apologize for that. But the vulnerable in these cases tend to be on the outskirts, and they get overlooked. And in this case, a lot of folks in nursing homes did. And hopefully your eyes were open to some of the things that are going on around the globe with this pandemic and the nursing home population. Pray for them. Pray for those leaders. And we hope that soon we'll be on the other side of this. We'll talk to you next week.